Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the, what day is it today? It's Cinco de Mayo, May 5th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here a little closer than normal because of the studio setup. Pardon me. He's an economist and author. He is the host of the Capital Record podcast, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It is amazing every single week. And he's the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Will, good to be with you, sitting next to you here in the studio, back once again, middle of the night from New York, here in California, to bring our faithful listeners the best version of Radio Free California we can deliver.
Ever. Well, it's the best we can do. I was in San Diego last week and met with a bunch of listeners. I do not have their permission to name some of them, but I think Susan Page will be good with that. She's a frequent commenter on the shows. She's awesome. Met with a few others. Howdy to those folks. Really delightful to see them.
You can't say their particular names, but you let's just say Proud Boys comes from...
I think these are people who are proud to listen to us because we are not Proud Boys. I think that's safe. Hey, today is May the 5th, but on May the 8th, I just want to mark this real quickly as an historical note. And because of the shortness of time today, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it. But it's worth noting that on May 8th of 1945, a guy named Norman Corwin wrote and released this massive show called On a Note of Triumph. Did you ever hear this, David? On a Note of Triumph? It is an obscure radio show Norman Corwin produced. And for people of a certain age among our listeners, perhaps, you know, people, if you're in your, certainly in your 70s or 80s or older, I doubt we have a whole lot older than 80s, but to you, shout out. You might remember Norman Corwin. He was considered at one point kind of the Orson Welles of radio. I mean, he was just an amazing guy. And On a Note of Triumph comes, of course, May 8th, 1945, just after the surrender of the Germans in World War II. So it's, you know, Victory in Europe Day, to be followed several months later by the end of World War II in Japan. And Corwin is connected to this show because he was one of my advisors in the Annenberg School of Journalism at USC. And just a wonderful man. Lived to be, gosh, I don't know, 104, I think it was, maybe older. Longevity lives in his family. But he lived in L.A. for a good chunk of his life and died here. And just an amazing guy. And I got to say, if we had more time, I would talk to you about how it is you can love someone whose politics are so different from your own. There is a deep strain of that mid-century American faith in the progressive movement, progressive politics and regulators, and we could regulate ourselves out of everything. FDR, of course, is, you know, huge still, though he has died by this point. Still a big moment in American history for the progressive movement. They're all, you know, sort of rallying around the flag left and right. And Norman was this just really sweet, older and tough guy who I learned a lot about radio from when I was at USC. Can't say enough good things about him. Know that our shared affection for USC might help you understand my affection for Norman Corwin.
Absolutely. I love it. And I love how you set the thing up by saying not too many people listen to the show in their 80s. And I think at least we have one of our two co-hosts who's in their 80s.
I'm working on it. I'm getting there. I just celebrated, how old am I? 63.
Yeah, 63 and
no,
80
62.
Is-
62. I'm 62.
When you don't know how old you are,
you can't count anymore.
That's a serious sign of age.
Yeah. Thank God I have a friend who's an economist who can help me with math problems. Yep. We got a great note from Ben Evanstadt, who pointed out that our talk about Mike Tyson missed something that he thought was absolutely imperative to share, and I want to share it with you because I agree with him. In the Mike Tyson beatdown, where Tyson went to battle with a knucklehead on a flight coming out of San Francisco, I did not notice in the video, Ben did, and points out that in the video and in subsequent pictures of Mike Tyson, you can see him holding a book. What is the book, you ask me? Did you already know this one, David? You know where I'm going with this? It's Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell. He's holding Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics. He pauses for a selfie with somebody in the airport, and he holds up Basic Economics. He gets out of his limo ride when he lands at the other end. I can't remember where he's going. I think Florida. Presents Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics again, and Ben's comment is he has always thought Tyson was a lot, he calls him Mr. Tyson, just like the New York Times. Mr. Tyson is a lot smarter than he's often given credit for, and this confirms it. In other weird news of the weird, Dave Chappelle is performing at the Hollywood Bowl a couple of nights ago when a guy rushes the stage, and I will tell you more about, quote unquote, the guy. But he rushes the stage to attack Dave Chappelle with a replica gun and a knife, and is quickly swarmed by Chappelle's handlers after he hits Chappelle, kind of knocks him backward. And the guy is reportedly dragged off stage. And Chappelle says something really interesting. He says, I just stomped a, and then the word is bleeped out everywhere I look. So I can't tell whether he's using, what a term of opprobrium he's using. But they did not handle this in quite the way that Chris Rock did with just hands off, gentleman decorum. This guy was beaten.
Well, but not by Dave.
No. But
by security.
By security.
He had a gun.
The guy had a gun and a knife. And
well, the knife was like in the gun.
Right.
What I said yesterday on Varney at Fox was, isn't that called a bayonet?
I think you're right.
They said he had a gun that like had a knife come out of it. I thought it was a bayonet. And I was like, this guy's got some kind of a
18th War II
century
fetish.
Action or something. World War II.
World War I. Well, they had him in two, but World War I primarily, yes. Yeah, it's just a weird moment. And frankly, Chappelle was funny. He made jokes about it later.
Well,
and
I heard that Chris Rock was there.
Yes.
And he said, was that Will Smith?
Yes. Which
so that's funny.
That's funny. There was a lot of
but
funny.
What's not
coming out
funny
of
is that obviously this guy intended to do serious harm. I've been to Dave Chappelle in Radio City, and they're not joking. They say they take your cell phones, they take your phones, your watch. So there's no video footage of what happened because, normally every single person would be sitting there videoing it. They all had their videos confiscated, their cameras confiscated. But that's why I kept waiting for someone to leak some footage. There is none.
There's not much.
No, they take it, and then they seal it.
In like a little bag or something?
Yeah, but it's like you can't get it open without a digital opening thing.
Hmm.
I figured I'll just open it. No, you can't.
I've never had that happen. For real.
And he started doing it, not for security reasons, but if you recall, the week before the 2016 presidential election, he was doing a stand-up in Ohio, and footage leaked, not of him saying, I love Trump, I want to vote for Trump, I'm MAGA, Trump. He just simply said, I think Trump's going to win. He goes, I don't think people have paid attention to his message, and there's poor white America, just like there's poor black America, all this stuff. And like what he said wasn't necessarily any big deal, but then people leaked it, like Chappelle being Trumpy, and then he just said, I'm not putting up with it. And then, of course, all the transphobic nonsense came later. I have never heard Dave Chappelle say anything that is remotely transphobic.
No. In fact, the production that he got in so much trouble for, was it called Sticks and Stones? I can't even remember. His most recent stage appearance that was recorded, which is awesome. And then Netflix had this massive outpouring of employee resentment that turned out to be 100 people who protested and yelled for a few minutes. That's what's interesting.
And you know what they call those 100 people if they work at David Bonson's company?
Fired.
Unemployed. Unemployed without severance and without parking validation. But I will write you a reference letter.
I'll bet you will. There are reports that the attacker was 22 years old, I think, 23, very young guy. And
do we know, just out of curiosity, do we know his race?
Yes, we do, but only because I had to pour through a bunch of stories in the immediate aftermath and discovered that none of the stories mentioned, but the video showed a guy being taken into an ambulance. He was black. this was not reported anywhere. And again, I don't want to be that guy, but I'm going to be that guy.
Well, I guess I'll be the guy. I don't care if he's black or not. You don't care if he's black or
not.
No. None of our listeners care. But
no.
I do know this. They would have publicized it if he was white.
Absolutely.
So it's not a comment on black-white. It's not a comment on Dave. It's not a comment even on this attacker. It's a comment on the press.
The media, yes. So that was the hook. And also that he was reportedly sort of offended by...
Now, you've been in the newsrooms with liberal agenda. Do they admit, like, ah, darn it, like, it turns out the guy was black who attacked Dave. Do people say like, okay, well, we can't run pictures? Is it, or is it just an unspoken thing? I'm wondering what the like protocols are in the New York Times, because I know with these shootings, and by the way, this is also the other way, that there are people at Newsmax that are disappointed when they find out it's a white supremacist.
Yes. Yeah.
And there are people at MSNBC that are disappointed when they find out it's a Muslim.
Yeah. Right.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
But my question is about the journalistic honesty. Yeah. Do they say to themselves, this sucks, we can't say the person was or that?
Keep in mind, as you might guess, I was sort of iconoclastic as an editor.
Yes.
And I also grew up in a slightly different, but an antecedent to the current newsrooms. Like when I was coming through journalism school, the big deal was your first test in journalism school at USC, where Norman Corwin taught, was you had to do an editing test, copy editing test. And one of the things they would throw in frequently was the race of somebody. And if you allowed the race of anybody to get into the paper, you were a problem. Because back then, the idea was you were colorblind. You did not mention the race at all, because that was seen as a legacy of the what would you call it, the apartheid South, basically, that you mentioned the race.
Jim Crow. Yeah.
And so there was, I think, this really kind of honest attempt to say, we don't care whether the attacker was black or white. Now, the one time it would make a difference is the suspect on the loose? What does the suspect look like? And I've seen stories more recently in the last few years where there's a suspect on the loose and we will describe his height or gender, weight, dress, but not his race significantly.
Or what I think is a bigger thing now than the race is his motive. Like, what's the affinity group?
Yeah.
When someone's like, he hung out in ISIS chapboards, but we also know he was very frustrated by rising tuition costs.
Yes, right.
You know, it's like, yeah.
Speculate about the motives.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But see, I can't remember who, so I really don't want to mess this up. I apologize. I don't know more specificity. Chris Steierwalt and my friend Ileana Johnson, who I think I introduced you to. She's at Washington Free Beacon, used to be at Politico.
She's great.
Brilliant conservative woman, journalist. They have a podcast together that is really focused on kind of exposing media BS, and they're really good. And they were quoting a study, but I don't remember. So this isn't their study.
Mm-hmm.
They were quoting another study. It was from a university or a think tank. It was objective and respected. But it was fascinating where it basically pointed out on crimes, they did something like 10,000 subjects of arrest, and that when it was a liberal paper covering a black suspect, the race came up like 9% of the time. And when it was a white suspect, it came up like 80%. Mm. But also there was some inverted truth to that too, that when it was a more right-leaning outlet, if it was a white suspect, it would be less and black more. So there, but my point being, that is kind of just embarrassing on the race side.
Yes.
And their point was it's not usually the racism or latent racism of the journalist or the paper. It's their belief about the latent racism of the reader.
Yes.
They're like, my reader doesn't want to hear
that
this was a white guy or a black guy, and so we're not going to say it depending on the situation. But I would say more than the color of the person, the color of their skin, is that when you say this guy was in a militia group, I don't care if they're white or not. I mean, if they're white, you say if they're white supremacists, it's kind of important. But it's, you got to get out. It's like the affinity group speaks to the motivation.
Yes.
And then inversely, I remember the day of the Boston Marathon bomber, Michael Moore saying, it's tax day. It's got to be some one of these anti-tax lunatic people. And then it came out. It was obviously jihadist driven. Right. And then they all kind of played dumb for 3 days. Those things are worse to me than feigned colorblindness.
Well, this has real world consequences, of course, in obscuring what's really going on in the world. And you and I talked about this, probably 18 months, 2 years ago, when there was this spate. It was during COVID, a spate of attacks on Asian Americans who were just, minding their own business, walking down the street, and would suddenly be set upon by a suspect who would beat them over the head with a rock or a stick or push them to the ground. And when they were elderly, a couple of these people got severely injured. And you had to dig deeply to find the race of the attacker. But that did not, when you found out that the attacks were largely, now this is going back and maybe this has changed, but largely attacks by African Americans on Chinese especially, but Asian Americans in general in the San Francisco area. The reports were, we've got to stop anti-Asian hate and white supremacy and Donald Trump. And yet the attackers were black, and they could not square that circle. And the result was you had this widespread sense that, of course, white supremacists, driven by Donald Trump's divisive rhetoric, were attacking aged, you know, octogenarian Asian Americans just minding their own business. It was a terrible story. And it did a grave disservice to the public's awareness and sensitivity to what was really going on.
It is a grave disservice, and it does have real world consequences, like you said. And I appreciate the inside scoop as to how it worked in the newsrooms when you were, you know, doing this. But I got to say, I strongly doubt that back in the day there was the pressure there is now to basically spike a story with omission.
That's correct.
And I also will say this: did you see the meme going around where someone had put about black conservatives that get like treated like Uncle Toms, and then they had a picture of, I think, Clarence Thomas or Herman Cain, and another black, I can't remember, and then it had Ben Shapiro. Did you see that?
No.
It's all over the place. And I'm sure it's some poorly constructed, what do they call the copy? Cryon?
Chyron.
Chyron, that just, you know, catches up a bad freeze frame moment. But it's pretty funny.
Well-known African-American activist Ben Shapiro. Okay, so in other news, David, I want to jump immediately to the real headline news here. And this has been covered almost to death.
No pun intended.
Boom. Some of our listeners will no doubt understand that I listen to NPR almost every morning, at least in bits and pieces, mostly out of a force of habit, but not exclusively, mind you. And, you know, as soon as this Supreme Court document on Roe v. Wade was leaked a couple of days ago, we're recording on Thursday morning, NPR pushed everything else off the run list. There were, you know, I think there was one story about, I don't know, women and children in Mariupol or something. And everything else was basically all abortion all the time. And of course, the big news out here in California was the speed with which California politicians, Nancy Pelosi, Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, et cetera, could not wait to jump on the story and declare war.
You really think that's the big story that they jumped on? I mean, that's not a surprise.
No, it's not a surprise. The big story is only a big story in California because, again, it is a disservice to the public to pretend. And I should not expect my politicians or the media to really reflect on what's going on. Was I surprised? I kind of was in this regard. It seems to me that if you're an honest politician.
Surprised by Biden, by Newsom, by Harris, or all the above?
Biden, Newsom, Harris, Pelosi are indistinguishable on this issue.
I totally disagree.
Okay, tell me.
Did you read Jonah Goldberg's article on Biden?
Did not.
He wrote an article about Biden's fear of using the A word. First of all, I want to point out what Biden said word for word. Was these Republicans want to take away your right to abort a child.
That's right.
Okay, by the way, you're not supposed to say that, bro.
No.
POTUS.
Yeah.
If you want to defend the right to murder a baby, you cannot call it a child.
A child. Don't do it. Yeah.
You're really not supposed to call it a baby. Unless you're consoling your friend who had a miscarriage, then the emotional sympathy is allowed to change.
Yes.
Now, of course, the person consoling their friend with a miscarriage should be consoling them because they did lose a tragic life. As Jonah points out, the only difference is the intent. And I'm not even arguing that the intent isn't different, but I'm saying it's a little odd to pretend like one is celebratory and one is this tragic event. Why don't we say they're both tragic events and that we just have a disagreement as to whether or not you should be allowed to create a tragic event or not. But that's not what they're doing anymore. Right. I see these people, if I'm pro-choice, I don't like who's representing their cause right now.
No, I agree with you.
Those folks up on the stage wearing t-shirts saying, I had an abortion, like a celebratory thing. The most politically, and again, I find it immoral and illegal. I am not defending it. But the most palatable stance on abortion that I think they've had to try to go down the middle with over the last 50 years was that legal, safe, and rare nomenclature. And that's not where they're at now.
No.
But Biden also said, and this was Jonah's article, is why if he were pro-choice, he'd be livid. He went immediately to, oh, they're trying to throw out Roe v. Wade. And I'll tell you what, next, they're going to be saying you can't get married and you can't do this and you can't adopt a kid.
Yes.
And what happened to this is supposed to be bad enough on its own. We've been fighting 50 years to support abortion rights, and he's immediately having to pivot. Why pivot to a slippery slope concern?
That's right.
Whether he's right or wrong on it, it happens to be ridiculous.
Yes.
But let's say it was true. Isn't the so like Jonah's example, which I fully agree with, was if they said we're banning all firearm ownership, would the NRA guys who've been fighting for firearm ownership rights for 50 years go, oh my gosh, now next they're going to ban our right to, you know, construct our own houses? In and of itself, the firearm ban would be bad enough.
That's right.
So Biden, to me, did not go down the lane and stick to the talkers that Kamala and Gavin
did. David, because Harris and Newsom and Pelosi, everybody I've read and listened to on the, let's say, center left, has done exactly what you said. They have pivoted from the problem of abortion to try to universalize the problem of privacy for everyone that's at stake. So for those of us who are opposed to abortion, we're now supposed to be concerned that we're going to be denied access to contraception. That was brought up by Newsom and Kamala Harris. They linked it to the right, which does not exist in the Constitution, the right to privacy, and have said that what this does is tear away any right to privacy. Now the state can control anything. And of course, this is quite the opposite. This is
they have a huge legal fight on their hands with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Because this is just, it's a legally absurd argument. But again, it does beg the question to some degree, do you believe that privacy implication exists in the 14th Amendment that any clear reading of it does not believe, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was more pro-choice and pro-abort than today's pro-aborts, yet argued that it should be codified into federal law under the Equal Rights Amendment, under Equal Protection Clause, not under
privacy.
So this is where I'm fascinated is I have been you know, we talk about guys like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, and who I think Glenn's kind of a lunatic, but there are certainly Andrew Sullivan. There are Bill Maher. I commend a lot. There are these few liberals that are real liberals that are leftist but classical liberals, and I find myself these days respecting them more and more. Disagreeing vehemently on the leftism, but appreciating the consistency of liberalism, what the ACLU used to be. Frankly, what a lot of Ruth Bader Ginsburg was pretty consistent, and then she kind of made some bad rulings. But what I was going to say on this is I would love to hear more from a pro-choice, pro-abortion who wants it federally protected or not, wants it state protected, but says Roe was bad law, and yet I demand abortion rights.
Right.
That is a more... It's not going to convince me.
No, but it's more palatable.
It's more legally consistent.
Yes, it's legal. Yes.
And it's also less divisive to the country.
Well,
I had to have a conversation with my daughter about this yesterday. She's saying, so now abortion is going to be illegal everywhere. I said, that isn't true. I go, personally, honey, I would love it for it to be illegal everywhere because I don't want there. But all it's doing is saying that the federal government cannot guarantee this right on a privacy basis. They throw out the Roe v. Wade construct. It goes back to the states. And then, you know, that's the thing I didn't really fully appreciate, Will. You and I talked about it. Why have we not heard story after story after story after story of tragic, unsafe, coat hanger type things in Texas in the last year? It's been almost a year. I think it's been like 9 months that abortion's been illegal in Texas. I haven't heard about women lining up in buses to go to New Mexico to get it done, or all kinds of backroom, unsafe I haven't heard about riots and protests. I think they've been doing okay without abortion in Texas.
Well,
I just think I was wrong on this thing. I don't think it's the political hot potato people thought it was.
Well, if you think about it at all, it's not, of course. All it says is I think the leaked decision says, in fact, that there is nothing. I went back and read Chief Justice Byron White's dissent in Roe. And now keep in mind, this is a guy who was a Democrat nominated by Kennedy in the early 60s to sit on the court. Again, Democrat, who was pro-choice in the early 70s, which meant a very different thing than it means today. But anyway, Byron White says something about how that, you know, first of all, there's no privacy right. There is nothing here for them to hang their hat on. And further, there's no real compelling constitutional purpose, therefore, for the federal government to step in at the court level. that if Congress wanted to do this, the Congress could do it. If the states wanted to do this, there was nothing blocking them from doing this at the state level.
And when Congress does it, or when the states do it, that is our way of saying the people did it.
Right.
Because at both the state level and congressional level, there is representative form of government.
That's right.
So really what they're arguing here is the opposite of what they say. They're saying the people demand abortion rights.
That's right.
And the obvious implication is if the people demanded abortion rights, the people would get abortion rights.
Yes.
By getting rid of Roe, the people would have the ability to apparently have their demand, you're so sure of, met.
That's right.
Their demand is for abortion rights. So let's just go see.
Well, here's Kamala Harris. And I think this is fascinating. One of the things that I think Marks points out, you'll love this, deep reference, 18th Brumaire of Louis
Groucho
Napoleon.
Groucho or Carl?
Probably both, but this is Groucho. This is Karl Marx.
Harpo!
This is Karl Marx. One of my favorite lines in the Marx Brothers, you probably remember this. I think it's Night at the Opera. He says to Margaret Dumont, I'll meet you here tonight. I can see it now under the moon. You and the moon and you. You better wear a necktie so I can tell you two apart. So here's Kamala Harris. And going back to Karl Marx, he says, the middle class is always trying to universalize its concerns by saying that the bourgeoisie, he calls them, is always trying to universalize its concerns. But that is a feature of all politics. And we saw it here with Kamala Harris saying the rights of all Americans are at risk if this decision passes the court. If the right to privacy is weakened, every person could face a future in which the government could potentially interfere in the personal decisions you make about your life. This is the time to fight for women and for our country with everything we have. Biden says roughly the same thing about this is a privacy right. Roe ensures a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. It also, at its root, protects the fundamental right to privacy. So again, that attempt to universalize, as you said earlier with the Second Amendment issue, if you take away our guns, are we going to start talking about our right to build our own homes the way we want? Newsom, who has been advancing California as a tourist destination for people seeking to kill their babies, has decided that abortion tourism is so critical. And let me just back up for one second to say that whatever your take on abortion, I know there are lots of, our listeners who, I think the most illuminating debates, frankly, take place in the sort of the libertarian world, where the argument has come down to a really salient point. Is the implanted, when does life begin? And who's going to speak up for the rights of that child? Now, there are libertarian absolutists. My daughter said, gosh, as a libertarian, I think you'd be happy that the government is protecting a woman's right to choose. And I said, well, who's going to speak up for the infant child? I said, it's wonderful to me when people say, I'm here to speak up for the woman and you as a man have no right to say anything about this. Well, where's the constituency for the child whose life is being cut short? Talk about a voiceless minority.
Well, sure.
So we've got the irony here. I just want to read this real quickly. I don't want to flog a dead horse here, but Newsom says, this draft opinion is an appalling attack on the rights of women across this country, and if it stands, it will destroy lives and put countless women in danger. So he's talking about coat hangers and et cetera. It will be the end of a fundamental constitutional right that American women have had for 50 years. And then he goes on. This is the most illuminating thing. I'm furious that my own daughters and sons could grow up in an America that is less free than the one they were born into. His sons and daughters have civil rights because people like us and Gavin Newsom have decided that individual rights are inalienable. These are self-evident, unalienable, sorry. So this is just, this gives real, I think, impulse power to a lot of folks on the left who are looking toward November, who needed something to distract us from every other policy fiasco. And in Newsom's case, of course, he has argued that, he's defending us from wildfires. He's not. We'll talk about water today if we get a moment. He's not producing more water. He's clamping down on it. We have all kinds of fiascos going on. And this is, I think the left thinks, this is their big payday. They've got it finally, and they can run into the June primary, the generals in November, and they can win.
Yeah, this is 2024 presidential. This is national brand building for Newsom.
For Newsom, yeah. Yeah. You're right.
But I think you missed the real story on Newsom.
Please.
when he said, if a man could get pregnant, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
How dare he?
And my immediate thought was, he's going to get banned on Twitter for transphobia and for gender, because people, you cannot do that. You cannot point out biological distinctives.
We call them birth people.
Well, and that's, and so to me, of course, I'm trying to like poke at the irony of it, but it's not an unimportant point. When, what's the expression? When the tide goes out, you get to see who's naked and so forth. These people.
You just made that up.
Warren Buffett used to talk about it with asset managers. With, when they asked our new Supreme Court justice if she had defined a woman after Biden said, I promise I'll nominate a black woman. Mm-hmm. And she said, I can't define a woman. I'm not a biologist. It was like, well, wait, but Biden says he's nominating a woman. It's like, how do you stick to your campaign promise if we don't know what a woman is?
Right.
So in a sense, like, there's a chance you've lied to us.
Yeah.
But of course, they don't really think it. It's a reductio ad absurdum. And Newsom is just admitting, to his credit, that a man can't get pregnant.
Right.
And that a woman can. And that the reason is that they have biological differences. And so I really commend Newsom for such scientific bravery.
Precision.
And biological precision. By the way, I haven't asked you your opinion. I do agree with him that a man cannot get pregnant. That is my view.
That's a weird thing, but yeah, I agree too.
And I agree that generally—
I've just followed the science on that.
That in terms of some of the scientific implications that women and the way in which God made them, that they can often get pregnant, that they possess the biological— I don't want to say equipment, but
I think that's right.
Now I'm in trouble. No matter what I say, I can't like really, you have to like walk on eggshells around everything.
Plumbing?
Here's my point. Don't say that. Here's my point. Newsom now is in a moment where all of us should be saying, this is the internal contradiction of the left. Because you have to pick between the fad of the moment. You're trying to appeal to what is a godless, secular, humanistic, leftist, preposterous sense of social, political, cultural, biological ethics. That this right to take another life, the life of an unborn baby, is sovereign, that the right of privacy, a woman can do whatever she wants, this kind of angry autonomy, not speaking to the tragedy, to the unfortunate existence of some unwanted pregnancies and what the right solutions are within a construct of dignity, life, and right and wrong. All of those conversations I want to have. I don't want to sit around talking belligerently about abortions because I want to talk to those women who are in a difficult position.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not the right person to talk to them. I don't have that skill set. I don't have that background. People are going to ask me what I agree with and disagree with. And I say, this notion that I want a bad outcome for women who find themselves in an unwanted pregnancy is untrue. I'll support anything I have to facilitate the cause of care, crisis pregnancy, treatment, spiritual, economic support, all of these things, health care that's actually health care, not
abortion,
the sadistic definition of it. But what Newsom did is basically have to violate what was their big theme of the week before, which was the denial of gender differences.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the world we're in now, is that from one week to the next, I can't keep track of what is the theme of the week. And I've brought this up before about the left getting away with it, with Islamophobia and homophobia. And one week it's like, we must respect all of our jihadist brothers and sisters.
That's right.
And then the jihadists say we were going to literally execute all
gays.
And then they go, we must respect the rights of our gay brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And I go, you guys, I can't keep it straight.
Right. This reminds me, we had a conversation a few weeks back when we were talking about state grants of millions of dollars to local communities in which city councils were getting to decide. Remember, this was like Palm Springs. I think West Hollywood was in there. And they had gotten this state money from a bill that was designed to protect kids who are aging out of foster care. So imagine you're a 17-year-old kid, you're in high school, you're going to turn 18 before June. and suddenly you're aging out of the foster care system, and you still don't really perhaps have a solid family base, and you don't have any separate income, what are you supposed to do? So there was this bill that said, look, we're going to protect two classes of people here. And Republicans signed on to this bill last year. And the bill said, we're going to help with transition funds for kids who are aging out of foster care. I would support that. I think you would. Yeah. And we're also going to support women who find women who are poor, who want to carry their child. We're going to support them with prenatal care, et cetera. Precisely the things you were just talking about. We can talk about these things. But here's what happens in Sacramento. That money comes pouring in from the taxpayers. The state government pushes it out to cities around the state. And many of those cities determine that the real at-risk people are trans. That's who we have to support. Mm-hmm. It's trans people. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's aging LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. These are not foster care aging out people. These are not unwed mothers or mothers in poverty or expectant mothers in poverty. This is a whole different class of people. It's not in the bill, and therefore it is illegal. I'm trying to talk to a few attorneys out there if anybody wants to get involved in this. But it's remarkable to me that this grotesque corruption of a well-intentioned law has not come back to bite Gavin Newsom in the keister and the entire state legislature. Shame on the people who have allowed this grotesque misuse of money that would do exactly what Republicans and Democrats voted for, support people who are truly at risk by specific definitions, two classes of people. So every time we try, Californians try to really support something that is not abortion, but maybe abortion adjacent. We don't want people to have abortions. We're constantly attacked on the right as people who don't care about the outcomes for these mothers or these children and unwanted pregnancies. And then we do something and they just misuse the money. It's a shambles. I also want to point out that despite Newsom's bluster about this attack and his children being less free, Californians voted in 1972, before Roe, mind you, voted for Prop 11. This is before David Bonson's even born, right? 1972?
It is before I was born.
When were you born? Like 1990, right?
1974.
Yeah. So we get this.
Always remember, it was Anthony Davis, 6 touchdowns against Notre Dame.
Is that right? I remember where I was.
55-24. That's the year I was born. I was born May 30th, and that game was in November 1974. So it's always easy for me to remember. Whenever I can't remember the year I was born, I just think, oh, no, that was AD. The Trojans won national championship. They were down 24-0 to Notre Dame, came back and won 55-24, and that's how we can always remember when I was born.
That's a sweet mnemonic. By contrast, I remember the year my father was born as the year that Adolf Hitler came to power, but that's a different story.
It is very different.
So anyway, we voted on this Prop 11, and it was written, authored by Ken Corey, who was a Democrat from Orange County, quite rare at the time. Ken Corey drafts this bill, and it guarantees in California the right to privacy, and the whole point of it was abortion rights ought to be abortion ought to be more accessible to people by creating a right to privacy in California. What's interesting about that is that at the time, of course, 1972, what was understood as a legitimate cause of, or appeal to get an abortion was you were underage, you were the victim of rape or incest, it might endanger the woman's health, it was in the first trimester. That's how we understood it when this stuff was being argued 50 years ago. And today the arguments are, can we kill it when it's on when the baby's out of the birth canal? Is it okay to kill it now? Can we kill it 9 months later? I mean, where does this crazy stuff end? It's like it is at some level become a death cult, and it is that slippery slope. We're going to approve money for kids who are aging out of foster care and use it for transgender people. We're going to approve abortion in limited circumstances in the first trimester. No, we're going to allow you to abort anytime you want. Oh, and by the way, if you don't live in California, California taxpayers will pay for your transportation, pay for your hotel accommodations, pay for your surgery. Oh, by the way, if you're a Californian who wants abortion, Gavin Newsom signed off on this bill in March, our listeners will remember. Insurance companies can't charge you anything at all. They must cover the entire cost of your abortion. Cancer, you're on the hook for yourself. Brain surgery, you're on the hook. Dying of a curable wasting disease, sorry, you have to pay the copay on that. But abort, absolutely. Yeah. That's how far and weird this has gone. Okay, I want to talk about Kevin McCarthy, about whom I know very little and have very little to do with. He's out of Bakersfield. Kevin McCarthy, the big news, you might remember, David.
I know it all well.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about it then?
I just don't care about it much. I think it's a national news story. It's not California, but that's okay. We can talk about whatever we want. Look, if someone were to say, oh, this totally exposes Kevin of being, you know, kind of a jellyfish, and he's one day saying he loves Trump, and the next day then he hates him, and now he's back to loving him, and you can't be trusted. I don't know that there's anyone who doesn't know that about Kevin. I just didn't know that there's anyone who doesn't know that about most politicians. It is a weird thing where, in this case, what we're supposed to be mad at Kevin about was that at one point he was telling the truth before he stopped telling the truth. But I just can only say, in this day and age, I don't think he had any choice. Like what President Trump has said is that McCarthy changed his mind when he found out the truth of the situation. But of course, he didn't find any new truth. There were no new facts. It was that politically, Trump lived past January 6th. And became, it looked like everyone was turning their back on him for his inexcusable behavior leading up to and the days around the riots. And then it turned out he was still going to be a kind of popular persona in the party. And so then Kevin went back to saying, now I'm going to go to war with Liz Cheney and I'm going to go back to, you know, visiting Trump and so forth. And they reunited and it feels so good. I'm not critical of McCarthy in the sense of, as a political actor, this is what he was required to do. I just simply point out this is not something that, you know, it's why I could never be in politics. I couldn't do it. And it's not because I'm morally superior. It's almost like there's certain self-respect at play. Like, I could not do this, like, one day going so far to one extreme, then back the other, like a ping pong. I think that sort of ideological flexibility is unbecoming of a what I consider a man. And I don't mean that in a gender way, but I mean, like, this is not how I was raised, okay? Kevin McCarthy is probably going to be a very good Speaker of the House in the sense that he will whip votes. He's reasonably well-liked. So the people right now are mad at him because he said Matt Gaetz is a lunatic. I'm not mad at him for saying Matt Gaetz is a lunatic because Matt Gaetz is a lunatic. And the people that are mad at him, like that he came back and re-befriended Trump, I say, well, your choice right now in this day and age is to do what McCarthy did, reunite and it feels so good with Mar-a-Lago, or it's to become totally irrelevant in the party. And there are people who are willing to be totally irrelevant. It's most certainly what I would do. I wouldn't stick around and deal with all this bullshit. I wouldn't do it. But I think that Kevin... let's just not get carried away with pointing out the like flexibility of it. It's kind of common in this day and age. The problem is with the people.
The problem is with the people in California. We now have a what has been called a mega drought, and we only have a couple of minutes to dive into a story that could take the entire episode, frankly.
Well, let's just talk about it till the drought ends.
Let's just do that. We'll have some time. Because
how long was the last drought?
3 years, I think. Was that right? Was how long ago, or how long was it?
Yeah, how long did it last?
3 years, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So we could talk for 3 years on this. Here's just the two headlines I'd like to juxtapose. Here's from Bloomberg. Headline is Mega Drought Threatens California Power Blackouts This Summer. Because there's less water flowing through dams, we have less hydroelectric energy. And of course, the governor and his cronies up there in Sacramento have shut down oil drilling, shut down San Onofre nuclear power plant, and intended to shut down Diablo, though now the governor says he's going to appeal to the federal government, to the EPA, and to others to allow Diablo Canyon to stay up and running, partly out of a recognition that we just don't have the quote-unquote clean energy, there is no clean energy, to continue to run California. The idea that you can get rid of all petroleum, which is Newsom and now Biden's real mission in life, is to eliminate fossil fuels, means there's no more plastics, no more fertilizers, no more chemicals, no more cell phones, no more everything around us that is made out of plastic is made out of oil. That's all gone if we don't have oil drilling. You can't make plastic out of electricity. That's not how it works. Meantime, same time.
Yeah, but you also can't make electricity without, for the most part, without fossil fuels.
That's right. So. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's the, yeah. But the point here is really fascinating to me because at the same time, we have the Metropolitan Water District, which covers much of Southern California, something like 19 million people, which is larger than most states. The Metropolitan Water District has come out and said, we're going to have to reduce all outdoor watering to one day per week. They're talking about a system, a police system, basically, a law enforcement system of fines, fees, punishments, new kind of police state apparatus to see if we're abusing our water rights in our homes. But we cannot have at the same time, this was the juxtaposed headline from the LA Times, drought boon or boondoggle? Critics blast Poseidon desalination plan as a crucial vote looms. So there are desal plants operating right now in California, one in Santa Barbara that I'm aware of, one in San Diego.
But what is the tracking of the water thing different? That's just at a meter level, not inside the home. Like they track the same thing with gas and electricity
sure.
now.
Yes, they're tracking our water, but more importantly, what the governor has just said is he's banning outdoor water use, and he wants a ban on any non-essential grass.
Oh, I know. Okay, so there's an overreach of the environmental regulation.
Yes.
But it sounded like you were going to a privacy issue. Is he going to tell you what you're doing in the shower, or just how long you have the shower turned on? I'm not following this, because they do know right now. Because I keep my pool pretty. I treat it more than I should, and I get the bill, and they shame you.
Yeah, they do. They give you a little sad face.
And I say I thought you're my producer, and I'm the consumer, and you're supposed to be excited when
I'm using
more.
Yeah.
And of course, I understand the environmental thing. Right. I'm not trying to make light of it, but my point is.
Yes, you are.
Do they have that information now at a meter level?
Yes.
As what total electricity consumption
right.
and gas consumption is. But them having that with water, that doesn't feel like a privacy violation.
No, it's not so much a privacy violation at that level, but the actual implementation of a ban requires people to report on you if they see you watering your lawn on the one day when you're not allowed
well,
to.
Well, yeah, that's
for instance.
That's a little Orwellian.
Washing your car. For instance, that's outdoor water usage.
But what if you say I'm watering my lawn and showering at the same time?
I'm not watering my lawn. I'm showering naked in my front yard.
Wouldn't that that could be a conservation tactic?
I like it. I like where you're going with this. But my point is that there is a planned a 20-year effort to build a desalination plant in Huntington Beach here by the company that built the plant in San Diego, which, by the way, is phenomenal. That plant in San Diego is amazing. I've been there. I've looked at it. It's awesome. They are using this thing called the Pacific Ocean to basically yank water out.
Now tell me about this. What is that? What's the Pacific Ocean?
It's a big body of water. Think of it as a large swimming pool, unheated by David Bonson.
Yeah, but there can't be that much water in it.
Well, it's not unlimited.
But why would a state that touches the Pacific Ocean on its entire left border be facing a shortage of water?
Because we have people at the Municipal Water District staff level and the Coastal Commission, more importantly, who have imbibed, they have sucked at the teat of environmentalist anxiety. And so they talk about things like environmental justice, the decline of our coast, et cetera, et cetera. Without balancing the there's no free lunch of we may die without water more quickly than we will die from an admittedly perhaps not as beautiful coast when you have a desalination plant. The one in Huntington, though, would be co-located at that big steam generating plant that's in Huntington just off Pacific Coast Highway. And there's another plan down in South Orange County at Dana Point where they're doing slant drilling to pull water through the ocean floor down into these pipes so that it will be basically filtered through the soil of the ocean floor and then pulled up. And so you won't see anything on the surface. It'll just be sucked out of the ground, basically. Anyway, long story short, I'll put this on the show notes, but if you read the staff report from the Coastal Commission, it is just shot through, marbled through, larded up with a bunch of environmental concerns that don't also simultaneously acknowledge that we might die without water, except by saying we just have to learn to conserve more. We have to conserve more. There's the philosophy of conserving more water and scarcity on the left.
Yeah.
And on the right, it's we know how to create more water.
Well,
this is not.
Well, that's a philosophical difference,
yes.
Is your point. It's an economic difference. There's an almost you could argue a whole personality, but I would say it's beyond a persona. It really does get to kind of a root view of reality. But the only thing that I'm always unclear on here is California. They will say over and over again, and they're mostly right. And I get in arguments with people on our own side when they will point out the high revenue stream the state of California has. And guys will say, well, no, we're falling apart. And I go, look, there's a lot of revenue generated.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of wealth creation. And there's a lot of So they'll point out, I think, I always forget, are we the sixth or seventh if we were our own country, largest economy in the world? I find this message intuitively, for someone who's not really in the weeds, intuitively absurd that you would say we're basically one of the wealthiest countries on earth and we touch the Pacific Ocean and we need you to shower less or water your lawn less. I would think most people would be like, well, someone's screwing something up.
Yes.
If that's it. Like in Kansas, are they walking around saying, please use less dirt?
Yeah.
You know, I don't, whatever the hell.
Save the corn.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't understand.
Well, if you listen to these
guys. The political
guys,
messaging seems counterproductive to me.
It is counterproductive. Now, in fairness, Gavin Newsom has endorsed the Poseidon Plan. And this, of course, as we've said before, instigated, provoked, elicited a bunch of really angry responses from the left, including the LA Times, which said, you know, this is just a disaster. Every story I've read about this Poseidon plant, which would be perhaps the largest desalination plant in North America, each one of them has said, this is very costly, and oh, by the way, let's look at how much money Poseidon, this company that would build the plant, look at how much they've spent in lobbying. It's like, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion, $900 million over 20 years. But they never look at the grassroots efforts of a bunch of other groups like Coastkeeper and Surfrider and others who generate hundreds of thousands of dollars in lobbying throughout this same period to fight it. Their special interest is radical environmentalism that will have us all freezing to death in the dark and with or burning to death in the dark and with no water. I could go on, but maybe we ought to wrap it up there so you can get to your next conversation, shall we, David?
Yeah, you've covered a lot today. This was good.
Thank you, buddy. Somewhere in here, I've got my notes on how to end the show, and I can't find it anywhere. So, you know, I'm going to have to...
I'm surprised you can't do it by heart.
I almost can, but not quite. Here it is. Got it. Sorry, people. There are probably people on the show who ought to just call in and record it on my voicemail. Let's do that one day, and we'll just have other people read it.
You give people your cell phone number?
I trust our listeners. They're awesome.
Yeah, me too.
David's going to hand out his phone number, but it's going to be remarkably identical to mine. That's all we have time for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show. Darn it. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. Please email us with your comments. I should say email me with your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our email addresses, but only use mine. And other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on at the Radio Free CA at Twitter. That's at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Raschuti, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi. That's the LA-based mariachi and metal band for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima. We'll be right back.